Buenas noches. Or buenas tardes. I don't know what the right for. That's all the Spanish I know. Quick show of hands. How many of you are alumni for Singularity? A bunch of you. And how many of you have read the book? And how many of you have heard me speak sometime? Okay, excellent. All right. So you've heard a little bit about me. I'm the founding executive director at Singularity. For 10 years, early in my career, I spent here in Europe restructuring large European companies, mostly French ones, which is why I'm bald, and I think you'll understand that better than most. And I was for 2 years the head of innovation at Yahoo, running their incubator. And I found that when you try disruptive innovation in any large organization, the immune system will come and attack you, right? Because all of our organizations are built to resist change and withstand risk, and yet that's now the high order bit. And how do we deal with that is one of the problems I've been dealing with a great deal over the last few years. Since the book came out, I've been talking almost completely to big companies on this problem. Every big company in the world faces this issue. I've been at the Vatican. I'm speaking at the UN in a week to the UN General Assembly about what they're trying to do. We have some very fundamental tensions in the world today on how do we deal with this? How do we transition the world from a physical to a digital environment? How do we go from real to virtual? What are the business models around that? Most importantly, how do you organize for the future? Right? In the past, we've had a world, every business in the past dealt with scarcity. For the last 5,000 years, if you did not have scarcity, you didn't have a business. But now we're finding business models around abundance. Airbnb is tapping into an abundance of extra bedrooms lying around. Uber is tapping into an abundance of extra cars or Cabify, et cetera. Singularity, many of you are familiar with, we're based at NASA in Silicon Valley. This is the founding conference 8 years ago where we brought 70 thought leaders together to see, is it worth creating an educational institution only focused on accelerating technologies? Right? And so we got this started. We live off this curve here that Ray Kurzweil put together. He graphed Moore's Law all the way back to 1900, and he found that we've been doubling computing power for over 100 years, well before Gordon Moore made his predictions. And the question that Ray asked about this data is, why is that curve so smooth and so predictable? We've had wars and recessions and ups and downs in the industry. You should expect a very jagged stock market type of a shape, not this very steady progression. And he looked at this for 10 years. He researched this, trying to understand this phenomena. And he came up with a very fundamental observation, which is once you take any domain or discipline or industry area and you power it with information technologies and it acquires informational flow properties, its price performance starts doubling very steadily. Most importantly, once that doubling starts, it does not stop. It just keeps going. And the upper consequences of that become very, very profound. Peter Diamandis, who runs the XPRIZE Foundation, how many of you are familiar with XPRIZE, right, which gives large power? So Peter is the founder of that, wrote this book, Abundance, and he charts out that if we could harness this pace of change effectively, that we will soon have an abundance of healthcare, education, clean water, energy in about a decade. And what would the world look like if that was the case? As of about 6 weeks ago, I joined the board of XPRIZE. So I'm now on the board with some very interesting people looking at how do you solve global problems using this prize approach. XPRIZE and Singularity University are kind of sister organizations in that world. That doubling pattern that we have lived through in computing, we're now seeing that in about a dozen technologies. We now have 12 technologies where the price performance is doubling very, very steadily. For example, in neuroscience, the resolution at which we can image the brain is doubling every year, right? And we're seeing this doubling. What we've done is brought together the world's leading experts across all of these areas, and we spend a lot of time teaching the future. Most academics is thinking about the past, right? How did this model happen? How did this equation develop? We're much more interested in where will this go. So we spend about 80% of our curriculum focused on the future rather than the past. So if you take biotech, what happens when we get to the $100 genome? Who are the thought leaders and labs in this area? Where are these technologies intersecting? What inflection points should you be tracking? And we've we kind of are part think tank, part incubator, part academics. We do very aggressively want to solve these problems. Here are some of our faculty, some of the most famous people in the world in each of their different domains come and teach. Our mission statement is, how can we apply accelerating technologies to solve global problems? Because today we have a dozen technologies accelerating, but also for the first time in the history of humanity, we can apply these technologies to solving global challenges. We've not been able to do that before. So we challenge our students to pick, for half the summer, we give them a deep dive, 300 hours of lectures, labs, workshops on the future of these technologies. And then we challenge them to coming up with ideas that would impact 1 billion people within 10 years. So they have 3 weeks, off you go. And then we launch those as NGOs, for-profit companies, research initiatives. We launch about 12 startups a year, so we have about 100 in total. This team was looking at poverty a few years ago. They noticed that in Africa, 85% of the roads disappear during the wet season. And how do you solve poverty if you can't move anything around? Chris Anderson came and did a talk on drones. At the time, people were very unfamiliar with this. Now, of course, we know a lot about drones. Typically, what happens is we tend to see a technology about 3 to 5 years before it hits an MIT Tech Review or Wired magazine, and then it becomes mainstream about 2 to 3 years later. So we tend to see things about 5 to 7 years before they become mainstream. This team had the idea, why not use drones to move medicine and food around, especially where you don't have roads? This is a live test from Haiti where they're delivering medicine to a camp. Now today, one of these drones can carry 8 kilos, an 8 kilo package, over about 10 kilometers. That's the range and capacity. But the underlying technologies are moving so fast, these are doubling in their capability every 9 months. Right? So by the end of this year, it's carrying 16 kilos. 9 months later, 32 kilos. 9 months later, 64 kilos. And that doubling will just keep going. So we're teaching our students to watch for these doubling patterns, layer solutions on them. The solutions will then scale with the underlying technologies. This announcement actually inspired Amazon to do this whole project for drones for package delivery. And the latest news from this team is they're actually delivering mail for the Swiss Postal Service, right? In a mountainous country, very interesting to see what happens there. Here's another example of one of our companies. These guys launched a 3D printer up to the International Space Station 18 months ago. Ironically, up at the space station, it turns out there's no space. It's full of extra parts, because if a screwdriver goes bad, you had better replace it. But if you can fabricate something while you're up there, very interesting. This photograph was taken a few months ago. One of the astronauts literally forgot his spanner, and they printed it. They beamed the design and printed it for him. Right? And of course, he can reuse that and turn that into a screwdriver or into some other tool as he needs to. Here's one other example. This guy out of England is taking tree seedlings, putting them in a hydrogel, wrapping them in a hydrogel. He can plant 1 billion trees a year using drones. Okay? And so we may be able to dramatically affect climate change just by this. And so, like I said, we're trying to inspire them to doing very crazy things. We do a lot of shorter programs for CEOs, investors, executives. If you're running a billion-dollar company today and you do not know what technologies are coming to affect you, you're not doing your job. Right? You end up as Kodak and Nokia or BlackBerry or Yahoo. And so we're bringing together an intersection of global problems, amazing people, and exponential thinking. And we hope interesting things happen as we swirl that around. Maybe one of the most interesting and unique characteristics of our model is we update our curriculum in real time. We actually, whenever some major breakthrough happens, we think about how does that affect all of the other areas, and we update our curriculum in real time. Okay? And the big challenge is, how do you spot this exponential change? Our brains cognitively are very bad at seeing this. If I take 30 steps linearly, 1, 2, 3, 4, I'll go 30 meters, I'll get to the door outside, and we can all predict very well where is 1/3 or 2/3 of the way in that prediction. But if I take 30 doubling steps, 2, 4, 8, 16, and I do that 30 times, I've gone 1 billion meters. I'm actually 26 times around the world, which is a bit further than the door. And it's hard to gauge where is 1/3 or 2/3 of the way in that projection. And more of the world is running at this pace. Our brains cognitively have a very difficult time with this kind of perception. When you apply this to industries, we see things in three layers. Most of our history has been very physicalized. All of the revenues and business models and money to be made was from the physicality of the world. You extract resources, you assemble raw materials, you move things around. Then we added products like your Kindle or iPhone, where the product is physical, but all the revenue is information-based. And with the rise of mobile and internet, we have whole industries today that are completely digital, with no physical manifestation at all, the music business being an obvious example. And we're seeing industry after industry go up that stack little by little this way. I write in the book that the Tesla is not really a car with computers and sensors in it. It's really a computer with wheels. Right? And you think of it very differently. Actually, one of our alumni corrected me and said, you're wrong about that. Remember, it updates itself every 2 or 3 weeks. So you have to think of it as an app that has wheels. And that really breaks your brain in terms of how we think about it. Just an example of how dramatic this is a 4-day event where we bring together CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And we bring them together for 4 days. You can see the logos here. We give them 2 days of briefings on these technologies. And for 2 days, what do you do about it? Roughly what I've written about in the book. We ask them beforehand, do you know about these technologies? And most had very, very little awareness. At the end of the 4 days, we said, how big of an impact will this have on your industries? 80% of them agreed that these technologies would have a game-changing impact on their industries within 2 years. So that's the gap that we're trying to bridge. Most people have very little awareness of what's coming. When they do, there's this oh heck moment, and I'm using the polite Canadian word there as to what to do about it. So we're seeing that when you digitize something, it becomes very, very disruptive. And we find that the best way we have of explaining this is photography. Some of you are old enough to remember film photography. You're operating on a material substrate, and you're operating from a scarcity model, right? You can only carry so much film, costs about €1 a photograph, takes a few days to get your prints back. When you move to digital photography and you information enable the environment, three fundamental things happen. The first is marginal cost goes to zero. I can now take 1,000 photographs, the cost does not change. As a result of that, the domain explodes. In film photography, I'm carefully clicking here, I'm carefully clicking there. Today, we're holding the button down on all of our devices and we're taking billions of times more photographs because the cost is zero. Then what happens, the third thing that's very subtle, is that you shift the problem space. In a scarcity problem space, I may try and publish books on photography, I may offer courses on how to do composition, I may try and sell very expensive cameras so I can optimize for each shot. In an abundance problem space, we all have 8 copies of our photographs on 10 devices and you can't find anything, right? And when you shift the problem space, you shift the business model. Nobody can make money anymore offering courses on photography because I just take 100 shots of my kid and I pick the best one. And so now it becomes a filtering problem, not a sourcing problem, right? And part of the reason we're seeing such disruption in music, electronic publishing, newspapers, books, and now cars, hotels, taxis, is the incumbents are all optimized towards a material scarcity-based world, and we're going to this digital abundance-based environment. And today, I cannot spot a single industry that is not ripe for disruption. We simply can't see it. Okay? Now, this explosion that we've lived through, we're seeing this in all of these technologies. We have 12 technologies going through this transition today, which is quite incredible. I don't have time to go through all of these. I did want to frame, just in a couple of slides, what we're seeing. So this is the cost of light going from 1300 all the way to today, so 700 years, that's the cost of light. And if you look at the shape of that curve, it was very, very expensive, then it plateaus and literally goes almost to zero. Right? And most important is the shape of that curve. Because here's the cost of DNA sequencing, and you see a very similar shape. Very expensive, plateaus for a while, and then literally goes to zero. Okay? Here's the cost of solar modules, exactly the same shape. And across all of these technologies, the cost is going to zero. And this becomes incredibly difficult to get our heads around, right? I'll lift up and give you 2 industries that we see being impacted. The first is healthcare, where we're getting more and more data streams from our bodies and tracking and doing data analytics on it. How many of you are familiar with the Tricorder X Prize? Can I see your show of hands? So a few of you. So Peter had a $10 million prize literally for the Star Trek Tricorder. Somebody would win $10 million when their handheld device can beat 10 doctors in doing a diagnosis. So when your handheld device can beat 10 board-certified doctors, you win $10 million. 330 teams competed for this. The prize was won 1 month ago. As of 1 month ago, we now have a handheld device that will beat 10 doctors in doing a diagnosis. Nobody in the healthcare world knows this has happened. Go ask your doctor if they know about this, and they'll go, nah, no es posible. That's basically what they'll say, right? You get this cognitive dissonance. Why? Because they've done 7 years of medical school, and there's no way a machine can beat them. But here we have it. And so incredible potential in rural areas where it's hard to get to a doctor, or in developing countries where we have a doctor per million citizens, right? If you're a hypochondriac, you'll love this device, right? You'll buy two of them because one of them must be wrong. It'll be chaos for a while. But maybe the biggest impact of anything that we're seeing today is solar energy. It turns out that solar panels are doubling in their price performance every 22 months, roughly every 2 years. Okay? At this pace, we can deliver 100% of world energy supply with solar in 15 years, okay? Which will have massive geopolitical implications. The Middle East will completely collapse. The US will have to find other reasons to go to war, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the relative cost of solar to other fuels. In Q4, 4 months ago, solar became cheaper than the energy coming off the US grid, unsubsidized. Okay? And so massive implications there, and I showed you the cost of solar modules. Now, two really important things about this. First is that doubling pattern just keeps going. So if we had 100% in 15 years, and it's doubling roughly every 2 years, it means in 17 years we have 200%. In 19 years we have 400%. In 21 years we have 800%, and that just keeps going. Okay? And so we're looking at energy going from scarcity. Through the whole of history of humanity, energy has been scarce. It is now about to become abundant. And the business models will disappear. Energy is about a $6 trillion industry globally. We should think that shrinks to about $1 trillion in the next 20 years. Okay? And so what do you do? We think the price of oil will crash. I spent 2 days last year in Saudi Arabia with the governor of the central bank. What the hell do they do? Right? And so huge implications there. And most importantly, if you're worried there's not enough solar out there, if you add up all of our fossil fuels in the whole world, all of the oil and all the coal and all the natural gas we have globally, that adds up to 5 days of sunlight hitting the world. So you shift the conversation from a scarcity problem to a conversion problem. The conversion is doubling like this. Already 25% of all of the farms in California are powered by solar. And my favorite example is this. The Coal Museum in Kentucky is now using solar panels to power itself, which is kind of the ultimate in ironies around this. Okay? In Chile, the country of Chile is already generating so much solar, it is giving it to its neighbors for free. That's happening today. And so this is going to radically change the world very aggressively. Now, interestingly also, the poorest countries in the world are the sunniest countries in the world. So this will completely change geopolitics globally. Okay? Now the big challenge is storage. How do you store all that energy? And so utilities are pumping water up hills and then using that, or we have battery technologies like this. Battery technology is lagging behind solar by about 7 years. But in about 7 years, by about 2023, 2024, when solar and storage are the right level of maturity, it means the business model of every utility in the world disappears. Because if I have solar and storage, I don't need a utility. And so they're in their own panic mode right now about how. I actually tried to live this. A few months ago, I took my Tesla, and I drove from Miami all the way up to Toronto, 2,500 kilometers. I would get on the highway. I would hit the autonomous car mode. Car drove itself. And because the charging stations are free, I went 2,500 kilometers, and it cost me zero. That's a Gutenberg moment. Right? You all remember the printing press. When that appeared, that changed everything. Today, we have about 20 Gutenberg moments happening all at the same time. I mean, just autonomous cars changes everything. Then you have drones, then you have solar, then you have Bitcoin, then you have neuroscience, then you have CRISPR, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the big challenge that we have is the technologies are all coming. They're happening. But as a society, we are not set up to absorb this pace of change. Every institution that we run, that we use to run the world, our civics, our politics, our legal systems, our healthcare systems, our education systems, intellectual property, all designed for a world a few hundred years ago, right? Not for today. Definitely not for a trillion sensors coming down the pike. We actually have to re-architect all of our systems globally, and our existing leadership cannot do it. Our existing leadership globally is set up to manage a status quo, predictable, linear, incremental world, and we're entering this very, very disruptive future. And so part of the challenge and part of the rationale for Singularity University is we need new leadership that understands this world and can navigate it better than our current leadership. Because the world is actually in a much, much better place than we have ever seen it. Okay? You look at, this is the last 100 years on Hans Rosling work, maternal mortality down 99%, the cost of telecommunications, information systems, and you will not see this in the news because it doesn't sell. Bad news sells, good news does not, right? And so even though the world is in a very great, fabulous place, on any metric you want to pick, we're infinitely better today than we were 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, any time in the past. But because we operate on a fear basis, we kind of vote on the politics of fear, and then you have Trump or you have Brexit. I tease the French a lot, but thank God for the French. They may have saved democracy, maybe. But every institution does not work today and going forward. I'll give you two examples. You take representative democracy. We invented democracy about 300-400 years ago when information was scarce. If you were in Washington, D.C., you did not know what was happening in California. The speed of a horse was as fast as you could find out. So you had a representative come and say, here's what my people are thinking. Today we have an abundance of information which can get misused, misinterpreted, or faked. And every major democracy in the world is broken. India, Brazil are broken. The UK broke last year. The US is breaking in front of our eyes. Because a democracy is designed for a scarcity of information, not for an abundance of information. Right? Or you take a more basic example like marriage. We invented marriage about 15,000 years ago. And at the time when marriage first appeared, average lifespan was about 25 years old. So you got married, you had kids, you died. It was not designed to last 50, 60 years. Okay? That's state-sanctioned torture is what that is, right? And we will double human lifespan in the next 20 years. Are you supposed to live with the same person for 100 years? That's crazy, right? And so very interesting. So every institution has a challenge. By the way, my wife gave me permission to say that, so I'm kind of okay in that sense, right? But we have two major concerns today. One is jobs. And not really the loss of jobs, but just the transformation that will happen in jobs. Here are 50 jobs in 25 industries that get affected just by autonomous cars. Just autonomous cars will have this huge impact. We're really worried about climate change, though. You know, this is the biggest challenge we think is facing the world. I've actually been living in Miami the last 3 years because according to our calculations, in about 25, 30 years, Miami is gone. And so better to live there now while it's still there than in the future. Now, from an economic perspective, a couple of major things happening. The first is the volatility is accelerating. It used to take 20 years to create a $1 billion marketplace. Now we're seeing that happen in months. But this is the curve I find most interesting. Newspaper revenues kind of trundle, up, 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 and then boom, they hit a deflationary cliff. A 6x drop in revenues within 2 years. The music business hit a 10x drop in revenues within 3 years. As we digitized it. And we find when we digitize a domain, you tend to see this deflationary cliff take place. Right? I predict this cliff will hit the car industry in about 5 years. Because in 5 or 7 years, it will not make sense to buy a car anymore. We'll have car sharing or autonomous cars. I have a 5-year-old son. I don't think he will ever own a car. He will never have a driver's license. Okay? Because it makes no sense to do that in the future. And it really speaks to how hard this is to spot. I mentioned earlier our brains cognitively are very bad. Let me give you a couple of examples. When the Google car first came out 8 years ago, the cost of the LiDAR, the GPS, the radar, the sensors added up to about $200,000 a car. And all the car companies globally said, cute research project, but you'll never commercialize that. Okay? 2 years later, it was $100,000 a car. 2 years later, it was $50,000 a car. And even then, the answer was, okay, $50,000. Who will pay $50,000 for all of the sensors? We're down below $1,000 a car today, and now everybody's freaking out, right? That LiDAR unit at the top of that Prius cost $75,000 5 years ago, and you can buy that today for $50, okay? And the next version will be $10, and it will look like this. And this is what's happening across the board in all of these technologies. I'll give you two more quick examples. In 2010, Ericsson made a prediction that we would have 50 billion internet-connected devices. And the entire technology world said, that makes no sense. There's only 5-6 billion people in the world. Why would we need 50 billion devices? I talked to Ericsson 6 months ago, and they said we were wrong about our 50 billion. Our new prediction is 500 billion by the end of the decade. And something we see very consistently is where you have a domain that's growing exponentially, the experts in that domain are wrong by about 10x. So this is not a math error, this is a cognitive error. And we find this in domain after domain after domain. One last example. In 2003, the leading expert in the world in solar energy said this. He said, look, if you add up the cost of the physical components, the silver, the glass, the wiring, we will never drop below $1 a watt. That's the baseline. That's as low it'll get. You can see the market actually believed him for a bit. Then it started to drop, kept dropping. We had 50 cents a watt 3 years ago. We're down today to 18 cents a watt. And his latest comment is at the bottom. He said, okay, getting below a dollar has exceeded my expectation. Okay? And we're fond of saying that an expert will tell you how you cannot do something because we're operating off old models. And it's very hard to get our heads around this. And the reason this is unstoppable is that all of these technologies are going through a democratization where the cost is going to zero, you get open source communities forming, and then you get radical disruption of the status quo. And whether it's drones or Bitcoin or neuroscience or biotech, they're all going through this point. Now, this has enormous implications for what you do if you have a business. We see huge disruption on the outside, but we're seeing internal side businesses radically transform. This is the big challenge that we saw. David Rose made this comment that all of our organizations are architected for efficiency and for predictability. They're not designed for flexibility, adaptability, or agility. We need to radically change these. The idea behind the book is we've learned how to scale technology very well. How do you scale the actual organization, which is painfully incremental and linear? But today we're seeing a new breed of organization that is scaling at minimum 10 times faster than its competitors. We have now found 100 organizations that are operating on this where they're delivering 10x performance better than their competitors by using a series of techniques. I'll give you two examples. A good one is TED. 10 years ago, TED was a nice conference, about 1,000 people a year going to Monterey. Chris Anderson took it over and he did three things. He established a huge purpose, ideas worth spreading. He gave away all the TED Talks for free, and then he allowed anybody to go create a TEDx event. And in 10 years, he's created a global media brand. Nobody has ever created a global media brand that quickly, and his cost was zero to doing this, right? So you can take an existing environment, apply a set of techniques, and blow it open to a global level today, okay? Here's another example, Local Motors, which is a car company out of Arizona. They have a social network of about 100,000 car mechanics and car enthusiasts that help design the cars. The numbers are amazing. If you're a typical car company, it costs about $3 billion to design a new car from scratch. Local Motors can design a whole car from zero for $3 million. That's 1,000 times better than the status quo. A typical car has 25,000 parts, theirs has 50. Typical car takes 1,000 man hours to put together, theirs takes one. A typical car factory is 1 million square feet, and theirs can be made on the size of this stage. So here you have four metrics on which we're blowing away the status quo on multiple orders of magnitude each. Now, if you're a typical car company, how the hell do you compete with that? And the answer is you don't. You can't. So you have three options. Number one, buy it and shut it down. Right? That's option one, which is what companies used to do. But now there's so many of these, you can't do that. Number two is lobby the government, pass legislation, and lobby them out of existence, right? Which is what also happens. But now the world is moving so fast, you don't have time for that. Option three is invest in them, buy them, learn from them, steal from them, whatever, figure out what they're doing and bring it back in. And that's what we're seeing happen more and more, where companies are partnering with these startups. And if you work for a large company, you're probably partnering with startups in that space. So there's three components that go into building an exponential organization. The first is they all have what I call a massive transformative purpose. Google is organize the world's information. Uber is everybody's private driver. TED is ideas worth spreading. Singularity, go impact a billion positively. It's a tagline with a social purpose built in that replaces the traditional mission statement. Now, 2 years ago, Paul Polman is the CEO of Unilever, ordered every brand in Unilever to take on an MTP. And as of a few months ago, we now have proof that the five most profitable brands in Unilever are the ones that have done this the most. So we're starting to see the model bite. Here's Coca-Cola's recent mantra, open happiness, right? So they're updating that today as we speak. Now, the second component is five externalities that allow you to keep a very small resource footprint and use one or more of these to scale very quickly. Uber doesn't hire its own staff. TED uses communities. Google uses algorithms. Airbnb is leveraging other people's bedrooms. And then you have digital engagement, feedback loops, et cetera, et cetera. Think about Uber. The mission-critical function in Uber or Cabify is to match driver and passenger. But that doesn't happen inside the organization. It happens out in the wild. And by enabling that with technology, you can scale infinitely. Then there's five internal mechanisms that you use to manage the internal control framework and drive culture, right? Real-time dashboards, the whole lean startup methodology, decentralized organizational structures, the whole lean startup methodology is one, and horizontal social technologies that allow you to do this. Not everybody does all of them, but if you do 4 out of the 10, our research shows that you can increase your performance by 10x. So 4 out of the 10 will improve your organizational effectiveness by 10 times. We actually created a survey where we said how you can actually score yourself and see how flexible is your own organization. Okay? And you can do this for free. We went on CNBC 18 months ago and we took the Fortune 100. So we took the F100 and we ranked them by how flexible their organization structure is. Most interesting from this is that Halt Business Schools did a stock market performance. And they found that your flexibility of your organization correlates with the stock market price, right? Because this makes sense. As the external world becomes more volatile, your ability to adapt is going to drive market performance. Most interestingly, if you had invested in just the top 10 most flexible companies, you would have outperformed the S&P by 3 times. So you're creating an index fund based on this. We're going to go score the IBEX, the Hang Seng, the CAC 40, the DAX, and just invest in the top 10. So that should do pretty well. And so that's the basic pattern around this. What we're doing today is running a 10-week sprint inside big companies. We found that we've developed a 10-week process that solves the immune system problem in big companies. We piloted it with Procter & Gamble, and we're doing that now with numbers of companies today. So that's kind of roughly where we're about. We think the world is in a fundamental leadership crisis globally, both on the business side and on the political side. And we hope by running contests like this to find the new next generation of leadership, arm them with this awareness, and then send them back out in the world. So many, many thanks to the Fundación for supporting this and our alumni for supporting this. Best of luck to the contestants. Hope we get a great winner. And look forward to seeing you at Singularity University. Thank you very much. Thank you.